Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event, able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And John.
And this week, boys and girls, we have two guests with us. They are the, I guess best word is to say, founders of Atomic Rex Entertainment, and they're also co-writing a story for the upcoming Terminal book from Eminent Press. So yep. Everyone, please welcome Eugene Selassie and Marco Lopez.
Hello.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
It's going good. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. It's a good day. Just came back probably about an hour ago from finally seeing Guardians of the Galaxy 2. That was a lot of fun.
Took you that long?
Yeah. Money's a bit tight, so really tight, but you know, I finally got around to seeing it today, and it's a really, really good film. Had a good time, a lot of laughs, and you know, Marvel makes good stuff. Fiddle's a little bit the same with the first film, but I enjoyed it.
The life of a writer, money's tight.
he's not lying. I still haven't had a chance to see it yet.
All right, well then, no spoilers. You know, Gene hasn't seen it yet. We got to be nice to him. So.
Say anything about when Optimus Prime shows up.
Oh,
dude, that was really good. Like, that threw me for a leap. I was like, what?
You know, if you're worried about if you're worried about money, you can just wait until Sci-Fi Channel runs out of shark-themed movies, and then they'll have to buy Atomic Rex off of you, because I'm sure that would make awesome.
Never happen. They always have one of those damn shark movies in their back pocket.
I'm wondering... You know that company Asylum that makes those ripoff films?
Yep.
I'm wondering why they haven't made one from Guardians yet. Maybe they did for the first one and I missed it. But they usually, like, you know, on a very successful movie, they'll do their little ripoff. So I was expecting something like, you know, something Space Warriors, you know, to see that on the Sci-Fi Channel. That would be hilarious.
They're kind of lagging behind, because that stuff has already been Rule 34'd.
Oh.
In fact, it was reviewed by the Cinema Snob, if I remember correctly. It was called Guardians of the Galaxy. But
sounds like your dating life, John.
Thank you. And
so one of the questions you really kind of like to kick things off with, and we'll start with Gene, is writing something you've always wanted to do? And is writing comics something you've always wanted to do?
Yeah, I'd say my earliest time reading comics... my very first comic, Iron Man 225, I believe, 1987. Yeah, I was 8 years old at the time, and from that point on, I wanted to write comics, and it eventually brought me to writing a little bit of everything, other medium as well, but I love comics 30-plus years. I'm stoked to be able to.
Cool. So, and is it something that you pursued in school, or... You just kind of picked it up? How did you actually get started?
It was something I picked up. I originally went to school for engineering, and somehow the writing bug got me and decided to, you know, follow my passion. Which I fought vehemently against forever and a day, because it was instilled in me, go after this career, but you have to do it.
Right. Oh, yeah. I think a lot of us have been down that path, you know. I've told the story many times on the show that I wanted to be a musician growing up, but the parents were always like, "Oh, gotta have a backup plan." And
I've heard that so many times. Gotta have a backup.
So what was your backup plan, Marco?
My parents wish that they had the first plan that they chose for me had been the only plan I went with. As a child, they wanted me to be a veterinarian, because I loved animals so much as a kid. And imagine their disappointment when I came home one day and I was like, "Mom, I found out what I want to do for the rest of my life." And she's like, "What? Be a comic book artist." That is not something any parent wants to hear. I grew up drawing a lot as a kid, And so before transitioning into a writer, a comic book artist is what I wanted to be. I even went for a year before I moved because I grew up as a military brat. So before I left New York, I went to the High School of Art and Design. And comics is basically all I want to do. Well, first when I was a kid, it was cartoons, like watching Disney. It's like, I want to do that. Mm-hmm. Then when I moved to New York and I started reading a lot more Image and that type of stuff, then it became, I want to be a comic book artist. And then in high school, it became like, kind of getting lazy, this art thing. But I like telling stories and the teachers say I'm good at that. So maybe I'll give that a try. And then that went into just writing and writing really bad and just practicing. Like, I didn't go to school for it. And it was basically self-taught. Hearing a lot of in the early days, in the early 2000s, like trying to get, you know, back then when you're stupid and you're like, you do the stuff you're not supposed to do. And you're like, please, Mr. Professional in the biz, will you read my stuff? And they're like, sure, kid, I'll be nice. And they're like, it's garbage. And you're like, thank you. you know, and then you learn. And then along the way, you know, I because I love movies as a kid and then in high school also. So I was like, you know, I want to do everything, you know, work in film and write comic books, maybe some novels. So I learned from people in the business and film and stuff. And I remember when Dwayne McDuffie was alive, he was really – nice guy that I remember being in my early 20s, and I would just message him and he would respond. And I remember one time when the old Static Shock cartoon was still on.
Yep.
And I was like, oh man, I was like, I'd really love to write for this cartoon. And of course, when you're in your 20s, you're just like, whatever, I think anything is possible. And I remember messaging him with like this 5-page thing I wrote. I think it was 5 pages. I don't know, it might have been more. It was for Static Shock, and he was super nice. He wasn't like, oh, get out of here, kid, you're being stupid. He was just like, this is what you're doing right, this is what you're doing wrong, this is what you need to concentrate on, and this is what a script actually looks like. And he sent me one of the scripts from the show. And, you know, and then from there, I remember, I forgot his name, but he wrote Thor 2, co-wrote Thor 2. He used to work for Marvel, co-creator of X-23.
Chris Yost.
Chris Yost was nice to me and Gene when we were trying to get a spec script into the Teen Tony, as I like to call it, the Teen Tony Iron Man cartoon they had on, the CGI one.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, we wrote a spec script for that. He really liked it. He was no longer, you know, working on the show, but he gave us some pointers on what we could do.
He had moved on from Iron Man Armored Adventures to, I believe, Avengers or Mightiest Hero.
Yeah.
Okay.
10 or 2011.
Yeah, so he, you know, he forwarded our stuff. You know, nothing ever came of it. And, you know, we tried to get into other cartoons, but, you know, it was always like back and forth between, like, you know, trying to get into film and trying to get into comics. So there'd be periods where I'd be concentrated on trying to get into comics, and then there'd be periods I'd concentrate on trying to get in film and then just learning it myself, taking notes from other people, and then, you know, it's where we are today, still working my way on getting into this biz.
So how did you guys meet and start working together?
Oh, man. I've known Gene since 2006, probably late 2006.
Yeah, about a little over 10 years.
Yeah, we both lived in Florida at the time. I used to go to this video store called Sound Exchange. Not Sound Exchange, it was Movie Stop. It was like a movie haven place here in the area of Florida we lived in. And me and a friend of mine became friends with, you know, a couple of the guys there. And it turned out one of the guys that worked there had a friend who owned a comic shop. And then it turned out that friend who owned the comic shop was friends with Eugene. So it was like a whole group of people that, you know, were friends with this one guy who owned a comic shop. And the guy who owned a comic shop was all our, you know, was our same age. And I was like, what? There's somebody that's 20-something owning a comic shop? I was like, don't you have to, like, be older for that and have, like, I don't know, years of experience? And one day, we used to go, like, every Wednesday, new comic book day, the comic shop would get together at this place called the OC, which is, like, Old Chicago, where they have, like, beer and pizza and stuff like that. Doesn't exist anymore. But we'd all go hang there at nighttime, eat, talk comics, talk what came out, what's going on, who we hate, you know, all that typical geek stuff. And one day, our mutual friend, Scott, was like, hey, Eugene's trying to get in comics. You're trying to get in comics. You guys should talk. And we talked, and then one thing led to another, and here we are, you know, 11 years later, still trying to knock down that wall.
Yep.
That almost sounded like you were going to say, here we are 3 drinks later, Baby on the way. Oh, but.
oh, jeez.
no.
so then, what was the inspiration behind Atomic Rex?
The name is just, I think it's just something I randomly came up with. Me and Gene lived in Florida, and then a bunch of us, our friends, moved to Austin, Texas. It was like five of us, me, Gene, and three other friends, and we moved to Austin, Texas. And one night, I was talking to a friend, and I was like, you know, it'd be a cool name for a band. It came out of nowhere. I don't even know why it came out of. You know, it'd be a cool name for an indie band, like Atomic Rex. Like, that'd be, like, weird. Like, you know, like, it doesn't even make any sense why there'd be a band called Atomic Rex. But I would be that band that would be like, we're called Atomic Rex. And people are like, what the hell does that name mean? I'd be like, I don't know. I just thought it was cool. and then a friend of mine was like, why don't you? I was like, you should call it a comic book imprint, like Atomic Rex Entertainment. And I was like, that would be awesome. I was like, that would be really awesome. And
then you got the commission for that sweet-ass logo.
Yeah. I paid some guy, you know, I was looking for a graphic design artist, and there's a guy that I forgot his name. This was so long ago. He was working his way into graphic design. Last time I heard from him, he was doing those wraps they do for, like, sports cars and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
So he was like, oh, yeah, I could do this logo. And I was like, how much? And he's like, $50. And I'm like, that sounds good to me. That's super cheap. And the whole impetus behind the group was just that, like, I was seeing, like, how when you have a collective that comes together and you're all working to trying to get into a business, it's a lot better than you trying to go by yourself. The old rule, whether you're going and trying to get into film, TV, music, comics, it's better to have going for group people because you have people you can rely on and how you can help each other and you're there for each other rather than just being the lone man trying to make it in and then being frustrated and giving up, you know?
Motivate each other, light the fire under each other's ass and bounce ideas off of.
Right.
And we had a few more people but, you know, as time went on, it just became like me and Gene. And that's where we're at today with it.
Cool. Cool. And so you guys currently have four strips up on the – or four stories on the book – on the website? Sorry.
Yeah, there's four different series. I'll let Gene talk about his first – why don't you tell him about that one, Gene, Rock, Paper, Scissors.
Okay. Basically, Rock, Paper, Scissors, if I had to boil it down to an elevator pitch, this is basically Goodfellas with superpowers. Three mob enforcers. Three mob enforcers. They're set up for taking out the head of the rival cartel, decapitated head of that crime boss and all. And so these three guys have to find out who set them up. And there's also a police officer that's working with the costumed hero that she can't stand, but they're also get involved in the conspiracy, and I wanted to go with something as out there as humanly possible to do in a comic, and this is what I came up with.
Cool, cool. And who's the artist on the book?
June Manaris. This guy is freaking phenomenal. He's currently he did have to take a hiatus. He was having some health issues, and he's going to be hopefully coming back to the book as soon as he gets done with two top secret projects that he's working on right now for publishers that he stated pretty well-known publishers, but he can't divulge any info until the summertime. He'll be making an announcement on it shortly.
So you release, I guess it's a page a week, online. It's, full art. It's penciled, inked and colored and, written by you. So do you guys do the whole, is the process all digital? Do you do it traditional and then scan it in? How does that work?
With the ones that I have on there with Massively Effective, which is a buddy adventure comedy, like B-list superheroes. With that one, when we did that, that was that comic I like to call the comic where I learned how to do everything wrong about comic books. And so it's that Trial by Fire comic. So with that one, I know the first issue, the artist Michael Main, he did everything on boards and then scanned it in. And then I think issues 2 to 4, or I think he might have done the first two issues on boards, and then issues 3 and 4 he went digital. I know with the comic strip Orion's Belt, the artists do digital, and I know with the short comic stories, A Shot of Whiskey, the artists do digital. I don't know if nowadays if any artists do boards, unless they're more of the artists that like worked in the 90s and early 2000s or before that.
Most likely.
So are you still pushing the Kickstarter?
No, it ended last
About a week ago?
Yeah, I think it was last week on Monday it ended.
Did it really end $25 short of like your final $6,400 goal?
Yeah, I didn't even think we were going to make it to 6,400. Like that was in a miracle in itself. We had done a Kickstarter for a graphic novel version of like all the stories.
This was about 2 months ago, and this was going to have all 10 stories together in one giant book. And the goal for that, if I'm not mistaken, was 20,000. And we came up short on that.
So everybody in the group, we basically restructured and we're like, okay, asking for a goal of, I think it was more like 16,000. Because there's some people that are in this collective of people that are known. Troy Brownfield, who's worked for Dynamite and Zenoscope, Eric Pilecki, who does some stuff with Black Mask, Justin Gray, he has a story that's going to be coming up and the next Kickstarter for issue 3, and we'll hopefully get to issue 4 if the Kickstarter goes far enough on that one. So it's basically a collective of people that, you know, have done webcomics or are known for doing stuff in the industry but aren't huge names but aren't, like, you know, brand new. And then, newish people like me and Gene. So basically we retooled the thing, and then we came up with, you know, we'll go Kickstarter for the first issue. That'll be 2 stories. And then if it goes far enough, you know, we can at the same time do the second issue, and that'll be covering 4 stories. And then, you know, if it goes further than that, then you go 3. But it went enough to do the first 2 issues, which covers 4 stories in total. And then down the line, I think in September, I think it is, we'll have the second Kickstarter. Yeah. But it did over, we asked for 4. It did $63.75. I didn't even think it was going to make it to that. Like, I literally, every time it made it to, like, another goal, I was like, I kind of feel happy. I kind of feel elated. Is this what success feels like? And then I remember I got to 6,400, and I was like, oh, man, we've got, like, half a day left, I think it was at that point, or maybe more than that. I was like, well, will this keep going? Is this going to go all the way to, like, maybe even more? Is it going to get, like, crazy? And then it just stayed at 6,400. I'm like, well, I'm not going to hate that. And then, like, the last hour or two or something like that, it went down, and I was like, oh, no. Is this one of those, like, where it's just going to, like, keep going down, and it's going to go, like, you know, 63, 62, 60, and I'm just going to be going there, like, why? And it stopped at, like, 63.75, and I was like, okay. I'm not going to hate that.
You always have to make sure you have a bit of a cushion when you're going for Kickstarter goals, because that can happen, and I've seen it happen many times. Friends that had crowdfunding sites.
So why is it going down? Is it just like people pledging and then going, psych?
I guess like I've seen that in other Kickstarters that I've like followed. It's been a while since I've been able to donate to a Kickstarter, but I've seen in other Kickstarters where it's just like it's really good. I've seen it in a few where it drops by 1,000, and I was like, I could swear that was up by 1,000 yesterday. I was like, who is the asshole who comes on there and goes, I'm going to donate 1,000? Ha ha, just kidding. F you. I'm taking that away.
Well, there also, I've been hearing that there are companies that will promise a pledge for such and such if you promise to either sign up to something or, you know, pledge to their Kickstarter or whatnot, and if you don't do so, they'll bail out.
That stinks. So it's trying to trade the donations kind of thing.
Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
That kind of defeats the purpose of getting donations.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There was one, we had one donation, and I was talking to Steve about this, there was one donation where somebody And it was, I think, before we were at the, I think it might have been before we were at the 5600, where somebody donated, and then they sent Steve an email, and it was something about, you know, we donated, and then some, like, investment thing, and you can, I don't, it was some weird thing where I don't know if they were trying to ask, like, you know, invest the donation money so that we can have even more money for the project. It was just some weird email. And Steve was like, yeah, that donation of theirs is probably going to drop in the next 24 or 48 hours. And they dropped it in the next 24 to 48 hours. And I was like, that is the weird. I was like, what is going on in Kickstarter land?
Paying for donations, that's a battle.
Wow. But did you said you didn't expect to get this high. So, I mean, when you're asking for donations, I guess – was you get 202 people that donated. It's like an average of $31.60 per person that donated. Now, are those people that you've met at Comic-Cons or people that you know or other players in this space? And is this something you think you can rely on?
They were all people that listened to this podcast.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Uh-huh.
Yeah, everyone needs to be listening to this podcast.
I personally, I know I had an old high school friend that I've known for like 20 years, and he reads comic books, and he donated, and I know I had another friend that donated, so I know there's like people that I know, but they didn't donate because they were like, at least I hope they didn't donate because they were like, you know, oh, yeah, you know, that whole like your parents, like, I believe in you, you're good, and then it's like, no, you really suck, I'm just saying you're good, but you know. So I know there's friends, you know, for any Kickstarter, there's always, you know, friends and family, unless you're a horrible human being or you don't have friends and family. And then, you know, that's just sad and I apologize. but, you know, there's always that. But I'd like to think that some of the guys, well, in the first two issues, I don't know if, I don't think there is anybody like Troy or Eric on those. I don't think they're going to be until the next Kickstarter. So, I mean, I'd like to say that I know Kickstarter made it a project they love, so I think that helped get people that, you know, donate to Kickstarter and specifically for comics to notice it. I know they did, I think they might have been on your guys' podcast beforehand during the Kickstarter, or I think it might have been another podcast. And I don't think we did this time around a lot of the rounds for, like, comic news sites. I know the first time back in January we did a lot. So I'm guessing there's also, because last time when it was the 16,000 goal, we raised about like almost eight. So I think there's probably some spillover from those people. And I guess maybe there's fans of people that read my webcomic stuff. I mean, I doubt there is, but if any of them are out there and they actually read my webcomic, the one or two people out of the, I think, 200 that came to that site monthly, thank you.
And did you really get a $500 donation?
Yeah, there was a $500 one. There was $150 one. There was a person who donated, I think, $500, and then they came back and they upped their donation. There was, I know there was a $100 one. I mean,
yeah. Those are the ones that I tend to be concerned with, but they didn't back out.
I think that was Troy's mom. Yeah,
did that come with a request for you to make a comic book about veterinarianism?
Yeah. You know, now that I think about it, that might not be a bad comic.
Veterinarian
by day, animal rescuer by night.
There you go.
So what's the story that you guys are doing for issue one for Terminal?
Ours actually issued two. And
okay.
Ours is paired. Our artist is David Landy, and I forgot who the colorist is, and he'll probably kill me. And be like, thanks for not saying my name, asshole. I believe Steve is going to be lettering it, and then we're teamed up. There's going to be another story in there by C.W. Cook and Aaron Pittman. And ours is very classic pulp tale. It goes back and forth between the past and the present. In the past, it takes place during the Harlem Nights. And it's called The Dusk, Sins of the Father. And it's basically about, what do they call it? An ambulance,
Yes, this, basically, this EMT, she discovers that her grandfather, who was a veteran, World War I, turns out he got, after the war, he became one of the biggest gangsters in Harlem. And I think, like, Eddie Murphy's character in Harlem Nights, but it turns out he found an artifact during the war that gave him supernatural abilities. And so it kind of sparked this big superhuman gang war going on in the 30s that it died down. And now our protagonist's brother, he found this, and he's also looking to step into granddad's shoes. So she gets embroiled in this huge gang war that not only is her brother involved, but her ex-boyfriend is, who claims he left that life behind, but he's now the number two guy for her brother.
Okay. I can see that.
It's very much, I'm a huge fan. Like, I love superhero stuff, but I love more pulp characters like Green Hornet and Shadow, Doc Savage, Spider, all those two-fisted guys with guns. Like, if I could personally have, I know a lot of people are like, no, but if I could personally have Batman, if I could personally have that small period of Batman that they had in, like, when he first came out where he had the two guns, which they later did with his dad, you know, in the Flashpoint, if I could have that Batman as a hero, I, like, would read that Batman all the time. Because I'd be like, at least I don't see the Joker coming back for the 15th time. but I love those characters. So when we were coming up with this, I thought it would be cool to do a story that's basically about a legacy pulp character, but it's a pulp villain, but in that mold of the Shadow and the Spider and all that. And it's about, you know, the sins of the past coming back to haunt the family later. And this twin sibling, the main character is female, the EMT worker. She has to, you know, clean up the problems that go all the way back to the Harlem Nights. And, you know, in the end, she, which I don't want to, like, super get into, but in the end, the kind of, in a way, it's one of those be careful what you wish for that, you know, you might, in a way, it's kind of like she might end up having to take on the family legacy to stop all the bloodshed and the mayhem that's happening and take a role and a family life that she left behind because she didn't believe in what her family did and the lifestyle they had.
Right. Huh. Cool. So it's definitely sounds like it's got some depth to it, which is good. I mean, you know, you don't always get that in a. I mean, how many pages do you guys get for these stories?
It's 16. For this one. I think we might be because it was a lot to put this story. There's a few pages in which I did the whole Watchmen 9-panel grid thing, and I was kind of looking back at them. I'm like, we shouldn't have done that. We might be splitting those up, so it might be 18 pages. I got to talk to Steve about that. I'm not sure if we'll be able to, but outside of those, it's like 2 or 3 pages that's like that. Outside of that, everything pretty much flows well. And David Lanby, his work is fantastic. He went for a very simplified, almost Mignola-esque style with his line work and inking. Very, you know, deep shadows, very simplicity of form. So it's going to be pretty cool, especially the design of the shadow and then of the, not the shadow, the dusk. anyways. Especially that look, it's very, when you see it, you can see immediately the inspiration of that. I'm not trying to like reinvent the pulp genre, other than it being a, you know, pulp villain story, which I think in those originals, everyone thought the Shadow was a villain. But you know, I'm not trying to reinvent it, just trying to have something fun and doing it from a different angle, except this time with, you know, an ethnic character as the lead.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to ask about that. You guys, with all the controversy going on right now with Marvel, you know, and the and the reinventing of characters and whatnot, I was gonna ask, you know, and I'm trying to think of, you know, I've always tried to think the best way to word these things without coming off sounding like a jerk or
man, just say it.
Well, okay, so you guys are both minorities. How do you feel about that and the importance, A, of minority characters in comics, and B, do you believe that was Marvel's downfall, or is it just they're not writing good stories?
I will let Eugene start first, and then I will answer. So go ahead, Eugene.
This is one of those situations where maybe a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B, whereas the foundations of, and not just Marvel, this is DC as well, they were created in a time, how can I put this elegantly, where basically they didn't really give a damn about minorities or women. So when fans clamor for the originals, you're pretty much 98% straight white male. And I mean, that's just the time they were created in. Now, in the interim, since then, one would have hoped that they would have built up more characters to give a really deep foundation to the universe. The problem is every couple of years when they hit that magic reset button, it's back to those classic characters because everyone wants the classics. Now, I'm not going to say this about all the audience, but a lot of the audience, the nostalgia goggles are strong, and it's not inherently racist, although a few maybe. I think a lot of it is just the nostalgia goggles are strong, and people are not willing to give chances to newer characters. That being said, the bombarding the audience with so many new characters in what, an 18-month period, 24-month period?
I think
that was a bit haphazard on Marvel's part. Honestly, there were a few I liked. I think some were executed very well. I think Kamala Khan, the new Ms. Marvel, everything was handled perfectly with that character. Sam Alexander Nova, it took me a little while to warm to him because I was such a huge Rich Rider Nova fan, but the stories were not only done well, but honestly, I'll say Jeff Loeb put out probably his best work in maybe close to a decade on that Nova title.
I disagree with that, but you know, that's something for later to talk about.
Uh-oh. Even then, Miles Morales, I thought was well, from his inception, was handled well. But it seemed like a lot of people took those and then tried to do their spin on how those characters came out, and rapid fire just dropping them left and right in comics, it did not feel organic, it did not feel natural, so there was going to be pushback from the audience. And although I don't agree with the audience, I anyone with a set of eyes can clearly see why they pushed back.
I mean, I look at it, I mean, it's really a hard thing, because these companies, Marvel and DC, you figure, I mean, DC has Jim Lee, so I know a lot of people look at Jim Lee and be like, look, DC loves ethnic people. They have Jim Lee, and he's a high position. It's like, that's nice. That really doesn't mean anything. Jim Lee's just a really good businessman, and he's a really good company man. Even in all the Image guys used to say that back in the day. When they got Jim Lee, if you watch, like, I don't know if you guys ever saw the Image documentary, but when you know, Jim Lee was that prize thing. Like, if they got Jim Lee, like, we got this. We got this whole thing with the Image thing. So him being high up at DC doesn't make me think, oh, DC's great with, you know, minority characters now. Everything's going to change because Jim Lee's got a high position. When it comes to Marvel, I don't know. I think it's honestly, when companies like that, it becomes, we've had so much success with the new Ms. Marvel and so much success with Miles Morales, that we're just going to, you know, keep going and beat you to death with these until it becomes so saturated. And then when the pushback happens, we're going to play like, we don't know how this happened. We don't understand. We thought you guys wanted this. Mm-hmm. For me, I'll be honest with you, and it might be shocking for some people. I 100% believe in the idea that, even though for me, I'll say right now, growing up as a kid, I never felt, if I never saw a Hispanic superhero character, I never thought to myself, oh man, why is there nobody that looks like me? And that's not me saying that there shouldn't be those type of characters. I'm just saying as a kid, I never had that because I grew up in a lot of multi-ethnic areas growing up being a military brat. But I guess my parents just taught me, like, you can be whatever you want. Who cares? You know, so I never as a kid thought I couldn't be Spider-Man because I was Hispanic. I was like, no, hell no. I'm Spider-Man if we're playing superheroes, or I'm Superman or Batman. I never thought I couldn't be those characters. But I did hate growing up when you had, like, a Hispanic character. I'm like, that's kind of racist. I don't know if you guys should be doing that, Marvel. Skin from Generation X. I was like, why is this Mexican got to be a gangbanger, Scott Lobdell? I mean, yeah. Come on.
A lot of those nasty tropes.
And but
even today.
But, you know, I feel doing the – if you're going to – for me, I did – because I contribute articles sometimes to Bleeding Cool. And if you don't like Bleeding Cool, I apologize. I don't work for them. I just contribute, you know, so I can get into conventions and try to make connections and all that. And they're cool and everything. Like, I've never had any problems with any of the Bleeding Cool guys, but I know they have a reputation. But I said in an article that I wrote a while back that – I don't really care for when you go make Falcon Cap, because what you're doing is you're not saying Falcon is his own character and good enough as a minority character to be his own strong superhero. What you're saying is Falcon doesn't work as Falcon, and he's got to take Cap, you know, to be a little militant and righteous. You got to be, I'll say, it's like you're saying, oh man, he's not good enough to be the ethnic superhero, so he's got to take the white man suit and, you know, and that's the only way he's going to be popular. You know, if I can put it like bluntly in that way.
Yeah, and these are always short-term solutions. It's like you're putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound instead of elevating like Captain Marvel, Black Panther, and numerous other minority characters. And a few times they've done so, like Luke Cage, I think, and over the past decade, we've seen some excellent work done with him. But it's not enough. And these Band-Aid on bullet wound, temporary elevation of characters that are going to be reset out of continuity within, what, 2-3 years, it's not helping. These are only short.
I'd rather you, not to drag this question out, but I'd rather you, you know, put your all behind, you know, something like Ms. Marvel, the new Ms. Marvel, Miles Morales, but not, you know, do that all the time. Try to push, you know, more newer superheroes of ethnic variety. But I also, at the end of the day, if I ever get to the point where I can write for Marvel or DC, I don't want to be contacted and be like, hey, do you want to write this Hispanic character? Because I'm going to be like, no, I don't want to get called to write the Hispanic character. I want to get called to write the X-Men or to write, you know, The Flash. I'm a huge Flash nerd. And X-Men, even though I haven't read X-Men in a while because what Bendis did to them, but, you know, that's another conversation. but, you know, that's what I want to get called for. I don't want to get called one day and be like, hey, we got this Hispanic character, because I'll just be like, you know what, that's nice. I'll see you at a convention, but I'm not doing that. And with Marvel, though, I don't know. I got to be honest. I don't know if their whole ripping off of Man in the High Castle for Secret Empire was a good idea. And that's probably something I shouldn't have said, because I'm sure – if there's someone at Marvel hearing this, they're going to be like, Marco Lopez, let's write that down. Asshole.
I'm kind of torn. Do we want them to listen to this, or do we not want them to listen to this because of you? I'm not sure.
That's okay. I've made my feelings on Bendis known quite a few times on this podcast.
But everyone was waiting for me to speak on that subject. And I nice guy. Guy does a lot of cool work in the colleges in Portland area. He's written a lot of stuff I actually like. I love Powers. I love Jinx. I love Goldfish. I think Ultimate Spider-Man was amazing. I honestly, truly feel that his Daredevil run is just as good as Frank Miller's. I know that's controversial, but I just feel once he steps outside of his comfort zone, and it, the book goes to like a large cast or something that may be sci-fi, fantasy, horror, supernatural, anything in that realm, the book kind of goes off the rails.
I'm trying to think of something he's written that I really liked.
Not to make this the Bendis bashing hour. Here's my problem with his with the X-Men. And one of the things that I don't understand, and I'm sure... And I've talked about this with friends at the comic shop, and I'm sure people have talked about this online. I don't understand the idea behind bringing the past X-Men into the present, other than a nostalgia factor, a weird like meta nostalgia factor. And I don't understand when they came from the past and they're all being very weird, like bottled water. Times Square looks so crazy. And I'm like, if I go online right now and look at pictures of Times Square in 1971, it doesn't look that crazy than Times Square in the in 2017.
Right.
It's one of the things of sliding time scale. I think they forgot about that because in all actuality, if the sliding time scale still exists, the X-Men were probably founded in the 80s or 90s, which means bottled water existed.
Well, and the, right. the funny thing about Times Square is I think the first thing they'd notice is, oh my God, that's an M&M factory shop. That used to be the XXX movie theater.
Exactly.
And that's a Disney store. That used to be my favorite video store. I mean,
Exactly. You know? So real quick, my like thing with Bendis, and I know everyone loves the Ultimate Spider-Man storyline, but he took, is it two or three issues before Peter's ever even in the costume and really becomes Spider-Man? Like, he drags out his origin story over, like, three issues. And any other comic, if you introduce it and you say, oh, it's going to be three issues before you actually see the hero, no one's going to buy it. But because you know it's Spider-Man, you're going into it knowing it's Spider-Man, and it's a retelling of his origin, and he's tying all this weird stuff together, people bought it, you know, and also, of course, you know, speculators buying the book because they think it's going to be worth money one day. And it's just like, but well, it wasn't that good.
I honestly don't know if that was particularly his call or if it was just a company mandate at that point, because I don't know where I read, but if I'm not mistaken, I thought that was one of the reasons that Geoff Johns walked away from Avengers was because it was kind of like a writing for the trade scenario and he didn't feel comfortable. I would need to look it up.
Yeah, there was a lot of that talk, especially in the early 2000s, that they were writing specifically so that they could get the 4-8 issues and put them together and put them out in bookstores so they get more readers, but maybe.
I do see what you're saying, that one of the things I hate about and sometimes I find myself doing it, and I'm like, no, is I despise decompressed storytelling in comics. And that whole taking, I don't remember that first story arc. It was like towards the end of the arc he finally became Spider-Man.
Right.
And it's just one of those things of like, I don't understand what was the reasoning behind that. And I get that people are like, oh, you know, character work and plot and stuff like that. And I get that. But, I mean, honestly, you could probably have done that whole story arc in like 3 issues. I mean, Stan Lee did in 1, but
not even in a full issue either.
Yeah, it was amazing. It wasn't like half an issue in Amazing Fantasy or something like that, or a page story. Yep. Yeah. oh man, if Marvel hears this or anybody that,
If Bendis, if you're listening to this and you want to come on the show to defend your career, you're more than welcome to.
Hey, that dude getting paid. I don't think he would be too mad.
I joke when I say that Marvel hears this. I mean, honestly, I'm not at that point that they care who I am. But I don't feel like I'm bashing his work. I just feel like I'm critiquing it as a fan.
We've been civil about it, and I, like I said, I spoke my piece. I've loved some of his work, and some of his work
it feels to me like there is no understanding of core concepts of things, and I'm not trying to be super nerdy and be like, you need to know what happened in X-Men 200-something from back in the day.
But at least do your homework, and it really feels like some books he did his homework on. Daredevil, I would never knock his knowledge of that character.
Yeah.
But I get a little frustrated because I've had to deal with them already on The Avengers, which is my favorite team book. It was my favorite. And now I'm having
to... Did he die and disappear?
He's gone. They heard.
Marvel came in and was like, nope.
You didn't know that Marvel had a hacking team?
Oh, there you are.
we lost you right at the end of your statement there.
Is he gone again?
Hello?
Hello, Gene?
Yeah.
All right, the rest of this interview will be with Marco Lopez.
Okay.
Are you guys able to hear me?
No.
Yes, now we can.
Okay, sorry about that.
No worries.
Right. All right, so enough Bendis bashing for now.
I say, I have to call it a Bendis love critique.
There we go. I love critique.
That's gonna be a new part of our every episode now.
It's the Bendis love critique of the week.
I like that. You guys should do it.
Ooh, alliteration. I like it.
But back to the original point. One of the things you guys were kind of talking about, a friend of the show who's been on a few times, Eric Cooper, who writes the novels, the Nightseeker novels. Like he said, you know, Miles Morales is great. You know, given Falcon, Captain America's suit, like that's all nice. But at the end of the day, the term he used was hand-me-down powers. You know, instead of like, let's just build Falcon up, or let's build Luke Cage up, or let's build Black Panther up, you know, make him the leader of the Avengers for a time. You know, it's like, no, let's give you an ethnic Spider-Man, you know? So,
yeah,
I don't know.
I agree. I agree with those statements. In that article that I wrote a while back, that's a similar thing I said too. It's you're giving me hand-me-downs, and I hate that. Any minority hates that. It's basically just saying you're not good enough to be your own hero, but you're good enough to be a hero that was previously a white hero.
Right.
And I honestly do believe that's disrespectful. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like Kamala Khan, is that her name? I don't read that book. I haven't read it since the first story.
Kamala Khan. Yeah.
Yeah, Kamala Khan. I apologize to the creators of that character. You know, that's a cool stuff, and Miles Morales is all cool and everything, but I do agree with the whole that it's a hand-me-down. It's not, especially including Ironheart, another Bendis creation, including the little, the Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. I mean, it's all hand-me-downs. It's nothing original. I think the only original character was Amadeus Cho until they changed him into a hand-me-down and making him a Hulk.
Yeah, and I really like Amadeus pre-Hulk.
Yes. I think a lot of people liked him pre-Hulk. Oh, well. We'll see what happens. We'll see what direction they go. Now that they're admitting there's an issue, let's see what they do. Are they going to reverse course, or are they going to just kill everyone off and start over again?
Hey, at least they'll admit there's an issue. DC, on the other hand, well, you know.
Well, Dr. Manhattan did it all. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, I know.
Two things. One, I guess the rumor going around is that Marvel's upcoming thing in the fall is supposed to be their quote-unquote rebirth.
Oh, God. Didn't they learn?
Wait a second. Wasn't Secret War really supposed to be a reboot?
Yep.
And they got cold feet at the last minute?
Well, I don't know. All I know is the upcoming thing they have, which supposedly that they said at, I forgot which convention it was, they said, I think it drops September, and at the last page it's supposed to be a real shocker, like some character returns, and I'm like, well, or some group, I'm like, well, it's going to be the Fantastic Four written by Bendis, and that's just going to make me throw a brick through a window.
Well, but, only if Fox drops the rights.
Yeah, right? What I want to know, because I just heard what you guys were saying about Rebirth, you guys not a fan of Rebirth?
Actually, I'm starting to become a fan with the new comics about they just did two about the button that Batman had found, and they're actually starting to introduce the Watchmen now. So, but it's looking pretty good, because they're taking basically the best of everything and putting it together and washing away all of the bad stuff that ever happened, all the bad stories and everything.
I with Rebirth, I don't know, if you were to say like who's your favorite comic book company out of the two, Marvel and DC, it would be DC for me. But I thought 52 was one of the worst horror shows ever.
Yes.
I didn't even like it in the beginning. Like there's certain things I liked in the beginning of it. Like, I remember when there's, like, we're rebooting, and I was like, again, you guys have done this with, like, Crisis and Zero Hour, and then Infinite Crisis. Yeah, Infinite Crisis then went kind of back, and I was just like, what are you doing? And then Convergence was just a god-awful mess. And Rebirth, I gotta say, from what that rumor mill that was going around, that was basically, like, 52 was all Didio's baby, and then Geoff Johns came back, and he's like, well, you made a mess of that, so I gotta clean this up. With Rebirth, the 48th page, whatever that thing, how big that thing was, I enjoyed that because I'm a sucker for emotional moments. So that whole thing being about Wally West, who's my favorite Flash.
Yes.
Jeff Johns knew what he was doing. Like, he suckered me into that book. If it didn't have Wally West, I would have been like, this is garbage. You're not getting any more money from me. But he put Wally West in there. There's the whole emotional moment. And then, I a lot of people might not shed a tear when they read comic books. I mean, I hardly don't. But with that issue, as being, like, remembering, like, what I got, you know, my first Flash comic and watching the old show in the 1990, and just being a whole fanatic about Flash and Impulse being my favorite Flash character, Bart Allen, and just seeing Wally come back and just all of that, it just really made me be like, holy crap, this is just really good storytelling. The Watchmen thing, I don't know whether that's going to be good or not. I'm really also enjoying, too, the Button story, though.
I'm glad you got your Flash moment. I'll probably have to wait another decade or so before I get my Iron Man moment.
That moment in the Button story where Bruce is talking to his father, emotional stuff. I'm just a weird sucker for that stuff.
I got to just before that. I didn't get.
Oh, okay. I won't say anything. You're gonna love it. It's really good.
Honestly, I loved Rebirth for the most part. But once again, I really like the early stages of the New 52, mainly because there, even though New 52 wasn't a reboot, they gave pushes to a lot of books and a lot of genres outside of the spandex superhero stuff that really got neglected over the past 10, 15, 20 years. You know, characters like Swamp Thing, characters like Animal Man, books like Demon Knight, Mystery Space, all of those. New 52 gave those other concepts a chance to shine. The execution of a lot of the books, though, left a lot to be desired. But I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I'm just saying, Rebirth seems to have addressed all of my problems with the New 52. I think it's too soon to say that Rebirth has gone off the rails or not. I'm still enjoying the ride.
Yeah, so my biggest problem with it was, A, it was the way they treated Wonder Woman. They converted her from, an eloquent statesman, also one of the best warriors in the entire universe, to being a brash brat sometimes. And, just they tried to make them all too young. And it kind of undercut the characters, especially with, like Wonder Woman is supposed to represent, basically, it's a woman character. It's like one of the holy trinity of the three biggest characters in DC. And they turned her into just a tank,
And then you're talking New 52, right?
That's why I like Rebirth, is because they're getting rid of all that crap and they're bringing back the nuanced, emotional characters and the experienced characters and the ones that have many facets instead of just the, I'm strong, I am going to hit you over the head,
The New 52 Wonder Woman had emotion. She just had one emotion. Yeah. Anger.
Strength.
Well, unless she's looking at Superman, of course. But
I hated that. I had a friend. I have a friend, Randall. I'll say his name because he listens to this podcast. He'd be like, "You said my name." he's a huge DC fan, and he loved that whole Wonder Woman and Superman relationship. And I was like, "No." I was like, "Here's the reason why that doesn't work. Wonder Woman would never go for Superman because." Superman wouldn't be her type, because Superman, yeah, he's strong and he can, kick a planet into the other side of the universe, but, she's already strong, she can already do amazing things, she wants somebody that astonishes her. She, back in the 80s when they would have her, I think it was the 80s or late 70s when they would have her and Bruce flirt with each other, it made more sense to me that Wonder Woman would be interested in Bruce. This is a normal dude that stands side by side with gods, She, no way in heck, would be interested in Superman. She's like, I see a lot of you in, the gods that bother, the Amazonians. Exactly. You're just the same old, dickhead. We don't care about you.
Yeah, exactly.
I could be wrong, but I kind of think a lot of fans have wanted that ever since the Kingdom Come book, where they end up together at the end,
Yeah. Well, the thing is, a lot of these future stories that they decide to bring in continuity Mm-hmm. I have to quote Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park. You always ask if you could, but you never ask if you should. And there's some that I would love to see. For example, that effed up Martian future from Kurt Busiek's Avengers Forever, where Black Panther was leading like the last remnants of humanity against a Martian invasion that wiped out all 10,000 people. I'm like, that's something I would like to see.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Kingdom Come, I think it told the story it needed to tell. Mark Waid is great at telling the story and then getting the hell out the way.
Right.
Problem is, they decided to bring a lot of that into continuity, and I don't think it's...
And that brings up another quote from Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park. Well, from the second one. First there's oohs and ahs, and then running and screaming.
I thought it was first there's ooze and then there are turtles.
The one thing that I want them to explain to me for the new, I mean, not that the new 52 matters anymore, they're all changing all that, but I wanted somebody to explain to me how did Batman in 10 years had 5 Robins?
Exactly.
In what universe does that make sense?
So,
and how did nobody think that was creepy?
It's because Batman and Green Lantern were the top sellers, so of course everything else gets rebooted, but those two that are making money, no. All the continuity will stand for those, which make completely no sense.
From my understanding, I can't think of his name, Snyder, right?
Yeah, Scott Snyder.
Scott Snyder, yeah. When he was working on the book, he didn't know the new 52 was going to happen. He just wrote a Batman story. So he wrote the Court of Owls and, you know, he submitted it and they were like, oh, this is great. This is going to be the launch book for Batman for the new 52. And he was like, okay, you know, like,
didn't something in Teen Titans, was it something was stated about Robins and that completely let us know, okay, this is new continuity. And then Snyder's Batman was like, no. Tim Drake was Robin.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. Exactly. So, because he didn't rewrite the history, but everywhere else the history was being rewritten, you know, kind of like in Marvel when Mary Jane and Peter's marriage gets erased, but nothing else in continuity is a touch. You know, it's like, does this make sense? No. Then why do it?
That should have caused some dumb effect.
The one thing that angered me the most of New 52... is their weird story where, you know, when they introduced the Teen Titans, and I'm like, is this Bart Allen? And then when they finally reveal his history, I'm like, who the hell is Bartor? What is this? I was like, what's going on here?
The less said about Superman, Superboy, and Teen Titans from the new 52, the better.
that's why I think another reason why I love Rebirth, because I'm just sitting there I'm sitting here on the sidelines and I'm just like, okay, so you brought back Wally. I'm like, where is Bart Allen? And but then I noticed with Superman, after the 4-part story they did with Mixpulix, when they did the aftermath of that and they showed the new history, I noticed they erased Connor and I was like, oh no, they erased Connor. That means Bart might get a race too. I'm like, fuck my life.
That also means Skynet, by the way, you know, because
it's just one of those things that I understand now why, you know, me and Gene, and I'm sure you guys, we're all from that generation that was just like, you get thrown into the deep end of the pool and you're like, figure out how these comics work. But I could see why nowadays, I mean, and it was convoluted in our time. I mean, just sit there trying to explain Cable to people back in the day. But now it's so much more complicated. It's like, how are you gonna, it's like, yeah, there was, you know, Superman when he was a kid, he was Superboy, but then, you know, there was a clone, and then there was a reboot, and then that clone was a clone of a son from an alternate timeline who then died, and then he, like, disappeared, and then, like, the original Connor got, you know, it's like...
And don't forget Superboy and Legion.
Yeah,
or it could be from the competition. Or yeah, just go back and read issue one.
Yeah.
Which one?
Which is why I think what's going on here is that they're going to use the Watchmen to literally wipe away all of this extraneous continuity and say base. And this is this is not my own idea. This is something I got from Comics Explained from Rob Corr, but it makes sense that it looks like what they're going to do is they're going to say, all you have to do is read like these four or five main story arcs and you will know the actual continuity. And then we're going from there. And it seems like, I mean, they've already like wiped up, well, they killed off the New 52 Superman. They killed off the New 52 Lois. It looks like they're like got targets painted on a lot of the other characters from the New 52, and they're slowly replacing them with all of the originals or something close to the originals. So it should be interesting what happens next.
Do you guys think that maybe given all this convoluted mess that happens with characters that never age, do you guys think it would have been better if maybe they had said the characters aged in real time? So like Spider-Man now would be like Spider-Grandpa, you know?
We've talked about that. I think mm-hmm. we agreed that, yeah, if they had passed their mantles on, if they had just let it progress, it would have been fine. I mean, you know, it's because you'd get better stories because you'd have different personalities coming up as the continuity progressed and people aged out. I mean, look what happened. They aged Batman out of being Batman. What happened? You get Terry McGinnis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know? I mean, and that opened up a whole new set of stories and bad guys. And it was so awesome that it's now officially part of the continuity. So,
I mean, DC's played with the idea, but they've never really committed it to it with Flash and Green Lantern.
Yeah,
you know,
didn't Image Comics start off that way where they did age in real time?
Yes, actually, Eric Larson, who we've had on the show, we talked about that where Savage Dragon, which is Spawn and Savage Dragon, are the only two books that have still been continually published since they launched. Savage Dragon has aged along with Eric Larson, so like. When he started writing it, he was in his 20s, so all the stories were, you know, were reflections of his life in his 20s. You know, now that he's middle-aged, the stories reflect that, and, you know, the things that, how he feels, it's what the character goes through. But I don't know if that works, obviously, where Marvel and DC, where you have multiple writers coming in and out of books.
And also their IP farms now, so do they want to risk not having Peter Parker around to do Spider-Man movies or not having Bruce Wayne around to do Batman movies?
Well,
are they willing to take that risk?
I think, I just want to say something real quick. The fact that I'm on a podcast that Eric Larson was on is pretty freaking cool. Cause I love Savage Dragon. I love Eric Larson. He's really blunt. And even though I don't always agree with some of the stuff he says, I love the fact that he says what's on his mind doesn't give two damn.
Yes.
So having Ant-Man aged out, I mean, at least in the movie universe, having aged out Ant-Man and bringing on one of the, you know, the new Ant-Man, that kind of worked.
Yeah, I agree it can work here. I think what it is Hollywood, which is made up of a lot of people that don't know anything, which is the old saying goes, you know, nobody knows anything in Hollywood and nobody watches movies in that business. I honestly think aging out would work. There, at a certain point, you can't have the legacy anymore. Like, you know, Spider-Man passing it on to his daughter would be cool, but then maybe she doesn't pass it on to her daughter. She dies as Spider-Man, and then a new hero arises that's somebody else, or maybe her daughter becomes her Spider-Man's granddaughter becomes a different hero. There are some characters that can't age. You know, like if Bruce was Batman and he, you know, retires as Batman and Batman becomes finite, and then, you know, Dick stays as Nightwing, and then you have, you know, Robin be Red Robin and all that stuff, I think that still works because it's like literature. People still read Lord of the Rings to this day, even though that, you know, ended a long time ago. It's a trilogy and then the prequel of The Hobbit, and then, of course, you have the side stuff like Silmarillion and all that, but people still read it to this day. People don't say like, oh, you know, I've already read Lord of the Rings 5 times. Who cares? You know, there's always new people checking it out and always people rereading their books. I think with certain heroes, you could have it where it's finite. It ends. It went on for 300 issues. Get the 20 trades like Hellblazer. The original Hellblazer is getting collected all the way to issue 300.
Same with Sandman.
Yeah. You know, and for me, when all those trades come out of Hellblazer and they collected the whole 300 issues, you know, I'm going to go back and start getting all the trades. And that's the only really Hellblazer I care about. I've heard the new one for Rebirth is pretty good. It's closer in tone, but I'm like, if you're doing PG-13 Hellraiser, not really closer in tone.
Exactly.
But Hellblazer, you know, that 300 issues, that's fantastic. And, you know, I think people are going to be reading Hellblazer 20 years from now. I think there's going to be some, you know, teenage kid, if, you know, there's still teenagers by then reading comics, or even reading comics, anybody reading comics by then. I think there'll be somebody reading Hellblazer that run and thinking it's fantastic. I don't think a book needs to go on 1,000 issues for it to be something that people will still read 50 years from now or 100 years from now.
No, that's true. I mean, we would have stopped reading Shakespeare a long time ago.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because now that you're saying this, you're making me think of like other concepts. Cause so if you take DC and you take a character like Superman, who is an alien from another planet and has all these powers because of the yellow sun, you can sit there and say he ages much slower than, everyone else. So you could have Batman die and then, Nightwing take his place, you know, and then somewhere down the road, Terry McGinnis takes over and he's, you know, the new Batman, and you could have Superman interacting with him and just, you know, reminiscing about how Bruce was compared to Terry now. And, you know, there's stories that are there, you know, but got to keep the IPs.
How awesome would it be if, like, okay, so Bruce, Batman in the 30s, he would have retired probably, good Lord, he would have retired probably by the 60s or 70s.
Right.
So he retires. So Nightwing has been going on being Nightwing since, let's say, the 70s. And then Superman, because, you know, he ages slower, so he looks like he's in his 50s or 60s, even though he's been around since, like, the late 20s when that book dropped. Yeah. That would be pretty cool. Like, I really do like the idea, as you stated. It would be cool to see an older Superman talking to, let's say, and now Terry McGinnis, who's a person who grew up in the 20th century with technology, and talking about how him and Batman fought crime in a world in which, like, you didn't have apps, you didn't have,
right,
you know, computers, you know, even though their world is kind of a little ahead of time. So, you know, back in those days, you know, Superman was fighting giant robots, but, you know, there were certain things that they didn't have, and it creates an interesting dynamic, and it also creates an interesting mythology, because I think it was Warren Ellis who said it, maybe he was paraphrasing somebody, how, like, superheroes are basically America's mythology, because we don't actually have a mythology. So it would create that sort of mythology that there's this epic history, this epic, these were guys that were around, you know, here's Superman, you know, during, you know, the civil rights, you know what I mean? Or, you know, and just creates this whole more epic legacy, more grandeur storytelling for something like that, other than, oh, look, we're going down this plot hole, which is good, going down this plot, which I think, oh my God, they already did that like 20 times. From the 1990s to the 2000s, right, and now. Because sometimes I feel when I read a DC and Marvel book, I'm like, didn't you guys already do this story?
Oh, like, but they're bringing back the Justice Society in Rebirth. So there you go.
or you sit there and you go, didn't Joker already team up all the villains to go after Batman, you know, 30 times already?
The Joker is one of my those characters that I don't believe in the concept. Like, I'm not to get into politics, but I'm a very moderate person, socially liberal, fiscally conservative, but there's some things that I believe, like, and I get it, comics are fantasy, so you can't, like, apply real world to stuff, but sometimes I think maybe they should apply the real world to Batman, and, you know, Joker gets in prison, and they just, you know, pull that lever, and I think they did. Didn't they give him the electric treatment at some point, where he got death for doing everything he did, and then he came back?
Wasn't that an Arkham game? The most recent one?
There are some side stories where the Joker dies and then comes back because he's implanted his brain patterns in another person. I mean, they did that in Batman Beyond as well.
Yeah, but Joker's definitely on my list of, look, I don't believe in superheroes killing. I understand they have to represent something greater than all of us, but there's a short list of should have been dead a long time ago. Joker's up there. Red Skull is up there. Mystique, honestly, even though she's number three for me, she's number one given how time she betrayed the X-Men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When will you learn?
Here's the thing about that Joker. Like, I love that Batman Beyond Return of the Joker. But here's the thing about the Joker. He does a lot of stuff that I sit there and I think, I don't think the Joker's smart enough to sit there and go, I should contact somebody so that they can take my brain patterns and put them into a chip that I can then implant into a child and then sort of like morph him into a new Joker. I'm like, it's like, it's weird. I know they say like serial killers, I think there's studies that have said serial killers have high IQs, but
that was like ultimate Reed Richards.
Okay. There's a lot of stuff that like,
right.
There's a lot of stuff that freaking the Joker does that I'm like, this guy's way smarter than he should be. And it's just one of those things that I'm just like, with the Joker now, nowadays, there's a lot of stuff that gets done that I feel is very much plot convenience, just so he can keep coming back, or just because I'm just, I don't know, he's not really, to me, he's not really Batman's Moriarty, but they play him that way, and I'm just like, I don't really feel the Joker, he's a serial killer, he's a psychopath, I don't really feel is that awesome to be in Moriarty. I don't know why you guys keep bringing him back. Like, yeah, Batman should have figured out a way to keep him in prison forever.
Joker needs a break. This happened. I remember when a few years back they decided to kill Sabretooth, and honestly, it was the best thing that could have happened to Wolverine. But it was what, 8 years before they finally brought him back. I think something like that is needed for Joker and a few other characters, but I don't think they have the cojones to take him off the board for any
prolonged period. Wait, are you talking about that Sabretooth when Jeff Loeb had him die?
Well, I wasn't a fan of how he died. It was the fact that they took him off the board for...
Uh-huh. I'll be deleting you off of Facebook.
Oh!
Hey.
That's just this podcast is for, bringing people together. And then tearing them apart.
Okay, all right. You know, so you guys, we've got it figured out. We have the new plan for DC. Hopefully someone over there is listening and they can... You know, Geoff Johns can work this in to their new 52.
Yep, world peace next week, right?
Yes, exactly.
And then the Middle East after that because, well, you know, it's the Middle East.
Hey, they should hire Marco to help guys.
So we're over an hour now. So I think it's we can start wrapping it up. And one of the questions we always like to wrap it up with I'd like to hear, an answer from each of you, and we'll start with Gene, and that is, how do you measure success?
I think there are going to be a couple of things that factor into that. One is, are you happy with how far you've come toward, how far you've gone towards your goal? Two, do you enjoy what you do? Three, do you have a body of work that you can be proud of? And four, do you see yourself making a living off of this within the next 5 years? And I honestly feel like I could say yes. So.
Cool. So you're a successful person. It's good to hear.
I agree with some of that. I figure I don't. You know, to me, success is basically. I do agree. You know, you can measure success by if you're able to make a living off of something. Because I don't know if I truly 100% believe in the idea. I mean, you have to be passionate for what you do, but I don't think that, passion can support you alone. Mm-hmm. At some point, you got to realize, passion ain't putting food on the table and keeping the electricity from getting turned off. But I feel, if you can pay, ultimately at the end of the day, when you make it into whatever it is you want to do in life, if it can pay the bills and there are people that like your work, because there's going to be people that don't like your work, but if there's people that like your work, and you can pay the bills and you still love what you're doing, I think that's what success. Ultimately, at the end of the day, success is getting to do what you want to do for the rest of your life, and it doesn't feel like a career.
Cool. I have been doing it wrong for a long time now. Cool. Well, I like both your answers. Very well thought out, So where can, before we call it a night, where can people find you guys online? What's the best place?
You go ahead, Marco.
The website, Atomic Rex Entertainment, is at www.atomicrexentertainment.com. I know with the group Eminent Press that we're a part of, we have somebody working on a website, so that will be launching soon. all the comics on the Atomic Breath website are free to read. The Kickstarter stuff, I think, will be going out to people at the end of summer. I don't remember when the dates are on that. I think it's end of summer or September or something like that, the dates for those. But we don't have Facebook. I mean, I have Twitter. I think my Twitter is at Atomic Rex Entertainment. I go on Twitter like once a day. To me, Twitter is, what is it, like Star Wars, a hive of, a wretched hive of scum and villainy?
It's at Atomic Rex ENT.
Yeah, I think it's, hold on, let me pull this Twitter up real quick.
I believe at Atomic Rex ENT.
Let's see here. Come on, stupid phone. Yeah, at Atomic Rex ENT. I go on there once a day. I just can't do the 144 count or whatever the small count of words is. Can't have a decent conversation with that. And then Eugene can tell you what he is on Twitter.
Okay. I'm at Gene Selassie on Twitter, and I'm also on Facebook, same thing. You can also see my work at Atomic Rex Entertainment and upcoming at Imminent Press, as well as I am also a sports writer, and you can see some of my work at oneofus.net under Smart Country and also at thescrumsports.com where I cover pro wrestling whole site.
Oh, cool. We could have talked about that for an hour. Next time.
Next time.
All right. And, of course, occasionally we can read Marco on Bleeding Cool, and he apologizes.
Yes, I know they have a reputation, I'm on there every once in a while. I do a article called You Never Heard Of. I like to, get indie talent attention, and not a lot of the sites do that. Like, Newsrama doesn't do that anymore. Comic Book Resources doesn't do that, especially when they got bought out. So I like to highlight new talent, up and coming talent, people that have had Kickstarters and stuff like that. I will also be at, if there's any fans in Florida, any people in Florida listening to this, I will be at MegaCon next week trying to get interviews from people and seeing if Dan Slott will be like, get away, you bleeding cool scum.
All right, while you're there, go up to Greg Horn, tell him Dave says hi, and that you would he would give you an interview.
Is this going to be a good thing?
Yeah, it'll be. I'll let him know beforehand. I'll text him tonight about it.
Okay.
Marco, you just got brought into in the middle of something that's a thing.
So I've been friends with Greg for 6 years, 7 years now, and it took 2 years to get him on this podcast.
Damn.
So
he's just a very hard worker, that's all.
He doesn't like to do a lot of interviews, so. But, if he's in a good, if he's smiling at the table, just go up and ask him and he'll do it.
I definitely will. Dan Didio's supposed to be there, so I'm going to try to go up to him and be like, this doesn't say Bleeding Cool, by the way, so can I get an interview?
I'd like to ask you guys a quick question. The magical, if you could write one character, what would it be?
If I could write one character?
An existing character or one you've made up?
Yeah, an existing, known character of Marvel or DC, who would it be?
You're the aspiring writer, John, so you answer first.
I'm torn. Well, as always, one of my answers has to be Squirrel Girl. And after that, I'm not sure. Maybe Beast Boy. Because there's a lot you could do with that character that I think he's completely underutilized.
I completely agree.
I agree too.
In my opinion, he needs to be with the Doom Patrol. I love the Titans, but I want to see him with.
Yeah, but definitely Squirrel Girl first try.
I guess I would either say Daredevil or Constantine.
Nice. Maybe, dude, I would have picked Constantine, but that is a hard right, man.
Mainly because I'm a tortured Catholic, and both those characters speak to me on that level.
I was just about to say the same thing. I'm sensing a theme here.
I always said if I were to write a British character like Constantine, his dialogue would probably end up sounding like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins.
Spoonful of sugar and all that.
Yep.
Cool. All right. So this has been fun, guys. And
yeah, definitely.
We are, so as I say each and every week, boys and girls, Don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Bye.
Are you strong enough to stop a stupid movie rumor?
Are you more powerful than a bad comic book event?
Are you able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have got absolutely nothing better to do?
Then join the conversation by connecting with us on Facebook, Twitter, Slack, and other social media platforms.
And help us get our capes from getting stuck in the door by becoming an official Patreon patron.
And if you just want more content from us, don't forget to check out our website where we post way more than we can discuss here.
So what are you waiting for? When you join our fight, everyone.